Last week, we talked about putting our hope in the wrong things. This week, we will discuss being afraid of the wrong things. In life, we are continually confronted with forces that seem to threaten God's promises to us, things that make us wonder if His word is true, things that make us question His power. These are sometimes big things. Things like government and culture and the forces of history. All of these things can make us question the future of the church. And yet, at the same time, we all know that something doesn't need to be big in order for it to be powerful. And there are personal things that can also make us question God. Battles with ongoing sin in our lives, persecution, turmoil in our families, personal lives, sickness and physical pain, emotional pain that comes from loneliness and disappointment and other things. All of these things can make us question whether God is being faithful to us. Well, the Jews had the same fears 2,500 years ago at the time the book of Daniel was written. They had been taken from their homes. They had been removed from Palestine and taken into the land of Mesopotamia, or the land of the modern nation of Iraq. That's where the book of Daniel is set, in modern Iraq. And they faced the very real possibility of extinction in the land of Babylon. They were a people who were living in fear. And the book of Daniel is God's answer to those fears, the same as it serves to answer many of our own fears today. Now, as we go forward in the text, we're going to be looking at two things. The first thing I'm going to look at is that most of our fears in life are well-founded. Most of our fears in life are well-founded. Now, this statement might surprise some of you, but a truth of our life is that the dangers we face and are afraid of are real dangers. Paul talked about this morning. Almost every power we encounter is stronger than us. We can't handle the situations in life in which we find ourselves. And that's not just me saying this. The Bible tells us so. And yet, at the same time, the Bible also tells us not to be afraid. Which brings us to the second thing we're going to look at. And that is that the reason we are not to fear is because our God is more powerful than the things that we are facing. We are not to be afraid because He is working for us. And ultimately, it is the trials and the dangers that are going to give way before His power. That is what we see with the Jews in the time of Daniel. Now, let me give you a quick history lesson here. The Jews in Babylon came from just three tribes out of the 12 tribes of Israel. They came from Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. The Levites were the priestly class. Now, the reason why there were only three tribes in the Babylonian exile was because the others had disappeared. If you'll remember, after the time of Solomon, the kingdom of Israel, which Solomon and David had ruled over, split into two kingdoms. There was a southern kingdom, which was made up of Judah and Benjamin, and the northern kingdom, which was made up of everybody else. Now, 120 years before, the southern kingdom was taken into exile in Babylon. The northern kingdom had been conquered by the Assyrian Empire. And it also had been taken into exile. And in exile, those other tribes simply disappeared from the pages of history. They were gone. They vanished. We don't know what happened to them. Like a piece of food, they were eaten by the Assyrians and absorbed into its body, the body of that empire. And this was the danger that was faced, or being faced, by the Jews in Babylon. Let me tell you, this wasn't simply a danger, though, for them. This Extinction was an almost certainty for the Jews in Daniel's time. You see, Babylon was an extremely powerful empire. And in the ancient world, once you went into exile, in a place like Babylon, you didn't come back. You didn't come back from that. It's not unlike what you see in sports. Now, I'm a baseball fan. As most of you know, and as a few of you out there tonight, I know also are. And in my lifetime, one of the most dominant players at any position that I've ever seen is a pitcher on the New York Yankees, still playing actually, named Mariano Rivera. Now, Mariano Rivera is what they call a closer. He's not a starter, but rather a closer. And for those of you who don't know, a closer, or let me put it this way, when a team has a lead in a close game, and it's going into the eighth and ninth innings, a team will bring in its closer to protect that lead and to keep the other team from rallying. A closer is basically a guy who can throw really hard, and they bring him in to throw really hard for basically one inning. And Mariano Rivera is perhaps the greatest closer of all time. And what the Jews faced in Babylon was the baseball equivalent of trailing the New York Yankees, or being in a playoff series against the New York Yankees, trailing them 3-0, losing game 4, going into the ninth inning and seeing Mariano Rivera come into the ball game. It's game over at that point. You don't come back in that situation. Now, it can be hard for us to understand the Jews' fear in Daniel's time because we know how the story ends. We know that they weren't exterminated. And yet, at the same time, we should be careful not to condemn their fear too much. Remember, the principal reason why many of us are ever afraid is because we are put in circumstances in which we don't know what's going to happen. The unknown frightens us. Now, there are some few times when the unknown can be a good thing. One of my great joys over Christmas was one afternoon when I was home, one wintry afternoon, and my sister dug out some of our old Disney movies for my niece to watch. And it was a lot of fun watching someone see 101 Dalmatians for the first time. I remember at one point she was sitting on a pillow and she grabbed the pillow and put it over her eyes because she didn't know what was going to happen to all those puppies. Now, this is funny and it's cute when it comes to a 5-year-old, and we really tend to enjoy the unknown when it comes to our entertainment. But the unknown is not so funny when it comes to most other circumstances in life. Indeed, I think we can very easily relate to the Jews in the situation they faced. All of us have been in those kind of situations. In fact, I'm almost certain all of us are in situations like that with things in our lives right now, things the ends of which we don't know what they're going to be. Now, the Bible tells us not to be afraid in those circumstances. But one thing that we have to realize as Christians is that there's a right way and a wrong way not to be afraid. There is a right and a biblical kind of courage that all of us must have, and there is a wrong courage that all of us must avoid. We're going to look at the wrong courage for just a second. Now, the wrong way to confront fears in our lives and the wrong way to help other people confront fears in their lives is to pretend that the danger isn't real. In fact, that's the best way to get ourselves or to get others in very serious trouble. Perhaps my favorite example of this is Napoleon Bonaparte at the Battle of Waterloo. Now, what you must understand about Waterloo is that Waterloo was the only time in the 50 major battles that Napoleon fought that he actually faced a British army. All the other battles he fought were against Russians and Austrians and Prussians. It was also the only time in which he faced the other great general of the age, the Duke of Wellington. Now, on the morning of the Battle of Waterloo, Napoleon sent his first corps away from the rest of the army in pursuit of the Prussian army, which he had defeated 2 days earlier at a battle called Ligny. Now, virtually all of his senior commanders who were with him told him not to do this and urged him to recall the First Corps, saying that they were going to need it in the coming battle with Wellington and the British. Eventually, Napoleon got fed up with their warnings, and he said to them, and I quote, "Just because you have all been beaten by Wellington, you think he's a good general. I tell you, Wellington is a bad general. The English are bad troops, and this affair is nothing more than just eating breakfast." Approximately 12 hours later, almost 30,000 of his men were dead, and he was fleeing back to France with the shattered remnants of his army. No, failing to see the dangers we are facing as dangers can cost us everything. But that's what many of us try to do in our life circumstances. It's what we try to do ourselves, and it's especially, very sadly, the way we often try to help others who are fearful. We'll say it'll be okay. And there's nothing wrong with saying it'll be okay, but why do you really think it's going to be okay? Now, if the reason you think it'll be okay is because you don't think that the problem's that bad, then you're setting yourself up or you're setting someone else up for your or their own personal Waterloo. The truth is, as Christians, indeed as decent human beings, we should never tell others, and we should never tell ourselves not to be afraid because we believe the forces that we're facing are weak. Israel, remember Israel in the exile, or not the exile, the Exodus, when it went out to conquer the teensy tiny little city of Ai. In Israel, what did it do? Well, it didn't believe it needed to consult God in that situation. Ai was going to be easy pickings. And yet, remember, I think most of us remember what happened. God used Ai to humble his people, to show them how weak they really were and how much they needed him. Ai sent Israel reeling back towards the Jordan. This is a lesson we all should learn. Courage, on our part, should never be based on the perceived weakness of our opponent or of the force we're up against. Only bullies have this kind of courage, and of course we all know from the schoolyard that bullies are cowards at heart. No, I'll repeat what I said just a second ago. We should never tell ourselves, we should never tell others not to be afraid, because we believe the forces that we or they are facing are weak. But rather, we tell them and we tell ourselves not to be afraid, because we know that our God is strong. We should never be fearful because He is our God and we are His people. And He has told us that He is never, ever going to abandon us. I mean, think about it for just a second. What need would we have of God if every problem we faced was simply in our head? What need would we have for Him if the dangers we faced weren't real? If that were the case, if every problem we had were the equivalent of the child being afraid of monsters in their closet, then we would simply reduce God to a cheerleader instead of a conqueror. And that's what God reminded His people of in Babylon. That even though they had been conquered, they had their own conqueror on their side. They were afraid because they didn't know what was going to happen. So what did God do? He told them what was going to happen. And yet He did so in a way that only God possibly could have. He told them what was going to happen through a dream He gave to Nebuchadnezzar, the king who had his foot on their throat. And that's what the statue is in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. That's what the statue and the mountain are. They're a history of the world from the time of the Babylonian exile until forever. That's what the text says. From the exile until the last days. You see, the statue, I'll explain here, don't worry. The statue The statue represents four kingdoms in the ancient world, four empires, in fact. We are told in the text the head, the glorious golden head, is Babylon. The silver chest was the Persian Empire, which conquered Babylon. The bronze legs and midsection, the empire of Alexander the Great, which conquered the Persian Empire. Now, after Alexander died, his empire was divided into four kingdoms. And three of those kingdoms were conquered by Rome. And the fourth kingdom was battered so badly by Rome that it was easily conquered by a group of Asiatic nomads. Rome is the iron legs and feet. Now, I want you to notice a few more things about the statue, though. It was made in the image of man. It represents the glory and the power of mankind to its fullest in man's empires. There's something even in our culture that recognizes there was a glory in the ancient world that we no longer have, or at least that is in a very different place than in man. But also notice what destroys those empires. It's not man, though that statue in the image of man isn't destroyed by another statue in the image of man. This is very specific why Nebuchadnezzar saw it this way, or why God made him see it this way. And the reason why was that God wanted his people to know that they weren't going to be their own deliverers. In fact, their deliverance wasn't going to come from any men at all, but rather, they were going to be delivered by a stone that was not cut with human hands. Remember what was cut with human hands in the ancient world? Idols. Idols were made with human hands. They were in everybody's household. Idols were not going to deliver God's people. God's people were going to be delivered by an object that didn't look like anything else in the world. They were going to be delivered, of course, by Jesus Christ. That's what the stone is. Notice also, though, what the statue was replaced by. It was replaced by something that man couldn't build. It was replaced by a mountain. Now, man has made many statues, probably millions of statues, in the time that he has inhabited the earth. But nothing, man's made things even bigger than statues, skyscrapers, and other buildings. But man has never made anything that can compare with the grandeur of Everest, or the Rockies, or the Andes, or the Alps. Yes, man's built many big things in his time, but he's never built anything as big as a mountain, anything as strong as a mountain, anything with the longevity of a mountain. And in the same way, no nation built by the hands of man can compare with the church, which has been built, or is being still built, by the hands of God. Look back at the text, and you'll see something else very interesting. And that is that the church rises in the time of the Iron Feet. The church rises in the time of Rome. Now, Rome is the Iron Empire. Daniel goes into great detail about how strong and powerful that last kingdom is going to be. Truth is, no nation before or after in this world has been as great as Rome. Rome is the power by which all other great powers are measured, including the United States of America. And while you can make a very good argument, the United States is one of the top five powers of all time, you could probably make a decent argument the United States is the second greatest power the world has ever seen. But the United States and every other nation in history has a long, long way to go before it could take over that number one spot. But at the same time, it's no coincidence, or understanding this, it's no coincidence whatsoever that Jesus came in the age of Rome. You see, God wanted his power to be on display to the fullest. And so what did he do? He set himself up in his Son against the greatest power that has ever been seen in this earth. the greatest power that man has ever built on his own. And this is why the church not only existed or was born in the time of Rome, but that why it endured the full power of Rome being thrown against it, why it was persecuted by Rome to the fullest ability of the Romans. And it's also why the church survived, and why it more than survived, why it ultimately conquered Rome. In history, great victories in war and in battle are often measured by the discrepancy in the casualties between the two forces that are fighting. One of the best examples of this is the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, where, my numbers are vague here, but the English and French fought during the Hundred Years' War. The French lost more than 10,000 men against probably less than 200 Englishmen. It's considered one of the great, most devastating victories in history. And yet, when you look at history, you see that those kind of victories aren't uncommon. But only one power in history, there are many powers that have conquered with great discrepancy in casualties, but only one power in history can say that it conquered a power, and that it not only conquered a power, it conquered the greatest power, without inflicting a single casualty. That's something that I thought of when I was writing this, and I still haven't wrapped my head completely around. But that the church conquered Rome without inflicting a single casualty. Now, how is that remotely possible? History tells us that it's not possible. Well, it didn't happen. One thing we must understand is it didn't happen through the men who were in the church. Rather, that's what happens with the God of the church, with our King, our great and glorious Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. That's the difference between a physical conquest, which you read about in history books, and spiritual warfare, a spiritual conquest. They're completely different things, and one is much, much more awesome than the other. One thing, though, we must understand, though, is that not only did Jesus conquer Rome, but that our great King is still marching against the great powers of the world. Not only is he marching against the great powers, he's marching against the circumstances in our lives. He's marching against anything and everything that stands against his people. You see, the last days in the Bible are days of conquest. The mountain is growing. It continues to grow. It always will grow. And while Christian nations may rise and may fall, the church will never fall. It's the envy of the world in that respect. But because not only will the church not fall, but the people in the church will also never fall. And this is the real reason why we are told and why we should never be afraid of things great or things small. And we're not afraid because the powers that we're struggling against aren't real. The power is real, but the reason why we aren't afraid is because those powers aren't God. Victory and conquest are only certain when it comes to the supreme power of God in His Son, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Yes, there are many powers in this world, but there is only one supreme power. That's why there is so much uncertainty in our world. It's one of the reasons things like sports are so thrilling. In 2004, in the American League Championship Series, the Boston Red Sox found themselves in the impossible situation I talked about earlier. They trailed the New York Yankees 3-0. And they were losing going into the ninth inning of Game 4, 3-2. And Mariano Rivera was coming in. But a funny thing happened that night in Boston. The Red Sox got a couple of hits, and they scored a run to tie the game at 3, then went on to win the game in the 12th inning on a home run. The next night, they found themselves in an almost identical situation. They were losing 4-2 going into the 8th inning. And again, the Yankees brought in their all-world closer, But again, the Red Sox rallied. They got two runs in the eighth, went on to win the game, this time in the 14th inning. They would go on to win Game 6 before blowing the Yankees out 10-3 in Game 7. It's one of the greatest feats any team has accomplished in the history of sports. In the 110-year history of Major League Baseball playoffs, it's the only time a team has come back in a series after trailing 3-0. The question many sports fans still ask is, why weren't the Yankees able to close out the series? Well, the reason the Yankees weren't able to close out the series is the same reason that Babylon wasn't able to destroy Judah. They were human. They were not God, in spite of what many people in New York like to think. You see, only God is guaranteed victory. There's not simply a 99.999% chance that God is going to win. No, it's an absolute certainty. In fact, it's already happened. The feet have already been smashed. Now, at times, there are powers on this earth and in our lives that have the appearance of being dominant. We must remember they are not. There are things, yes, that are working against us, but our God is working against those things. The statue is gone. The mountain is established. We are in the last days. But they are the last days for us only in the sense that they are the last days that we will ever be afraid. The kingdom has been established, and King Jesus dominates all things.